Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. El Cajon has approved a plan to shelter dogs for homeless people and will have details. The Mother Goose Parade, a Thanksgiving tradition for 75 years, has been canceled again. Our East County Magazine investigative report reveals a very troubling situation. In Julian, residents are voicing concerns after a campfire at a vacation rental sparked a brush fire. The Sheriff's Department is asking public help to find one or more students in a mass shooting during a birthday party in Spring Valley Saturday night, where five people were injured by gunshots. Santee's City Council has approved building a Ukrainian church. We'll have details. On Destination East County, hear about delightful holiday events coming up, from light displays, craft fairs and festivals, to outdoors ice skating, a Nutcracker ballet performance, and more. Padres owner Pete Seidler, whose investments led the team to the playoffs last year, has died. And at the national level, leading conservative voices are joining liberals in speaking out on the threats that Donald Trump poses to our democracy. From Public News Service, we'll have more national news, including farmers seeking help to address climate change, the death of former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, growth in labor unions, a possible breakthrough to free hostages held by Hamas, peace protests at the California Democratic Convention, the release of January 6 videos by the new speaker, and a tribal voting rights issue. So stay tuned for the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ, where East County matters.
By a unanimous vote, El Cajon City Council members have approved funding for the Humane Society to provide shelter for dogs belonging to homeless people for up to 30 days, provided the person enters a homeless program to get shelter and services. The measure also funds veterinary care per pet. Councilman Gary Kendrick, who introduced the measure, says, "It's removing one more barrier to getting people off the street." He notes that local homeless shelters won't accept pets, but adds that a lot of homeless people are saying, "I don't want to lose my dog, so I won't go into a program." A homeless person can retrieve their dog from the Humane Society after they complete a program in 30 days or sooner if they choose. They can leave the program and get their dog back at any time, assures Kendrick, a dog owner. The city allocated $30,000 for the first year of the program. The cost for the Humane Society to shelter a dog for 30 days is $400 per animal, an investment that could save taxpayers money in the long run by reducing other costs linked to homelessness, such as policing and cleanup expenditures. The shelter will provide medical care for pets up to a maximum of $2,000 per dog, including vaccinations and treatment of medical conditions, as well as dog licensing. Kendrick told East County Magazine after the vote, "Chances are the dog will be a lot better coming out than he was coming in." The city of Carlsbad has a similar program, but it only provides 2 weeks of shelter for homeless pets. El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells, a mental health practitioner who often treats homeless people in crisis situations, notes that 2 weeks is not enough time for a person to get clean if they are addicted to drugs or alcohol. So El Cajon opted for 30 days. El Cajon's council members have long been empathetic to the homeless. Two council members, Michelle Mitchell and Phil Ortiz, have been homeless in the past. Councilman Kendrick has taken homeless people into his home for temporary lodging after they completed a program to help them transition off the streets. Councilman Steve Goble has helped build emergency sleeping cabins for the homeless. Mayor Wells, also a musician, headlines a concert each year to raise money for the East County Transitional Living Center, a shelter that provides services to help homeless people and families transition off the streets. Kendrick believes the new program to enable homeless people to seek help without having to give up their pets is the right thing to do. I hope we spend the entire $30,000 because it gets people off the streets, he says. That's the goal. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is John Tidwell.
For the fourth year in a row, there will be no Mother Goose Parade in El Cajon this Thanksgiving weekend, and the Parade Association's officers are ducking media inquiries. An East County Magazine investigation into the El Cajon Valley Mother Goose Parade Association reveals troubling findings, including financial losses and consulting fees paid out with no tangible results. The association's donation page has been taken down, and no fundraising events are listed. And yet, the association's website states, this beloved event shall be reimagined as a new classic in 2024. If true, why won't they respond to media inquiries to publicize ways that the public might support the parade? The parade, a tradition since 1947, went virtual during the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020 and 2021. In 2022, the website announced cancellation due to unprecedented staffing, logistics, and supply chain challenges. But back then, they promised that the annual tradition would be back bigger and better than ever in 2023. That didn't happen, and the lack of transparency raises serious questions over whether there will be a parade in 2024 or ever again, unless the public steps forward to save the parade and provide a fairy tale ending. The California Secretary of State's website lists the El Cajon Valley Mother Goose Parade Association as still active, though it has not submitted any filings since 2020, other than resignation of its agent of service, an accountant who retired. The 2020 filing listed two officers, developer Daryl Priest as chief executive officer and Patty Tuttle Shyrock as secretary, both at the same address as Priest's company, DP Homes. GuideStar, an organization that provides data on nonprofits, has the Parade Association's Form 990 tax filings, that's federal tax filings, for 2019, 2020, and 2021. In 2019, the last year in which a live parade was actually held, the organization had over $73,000 in revenues and $62,000 in expenses, with a positive balance at year's end of a little over $12,000. But in 2020, when COVID hit, the Parade Association finished the year with more than $18,000 in the hole. The group raised less than $6,000 and had over $36,000 in expenses. In 2021, the group spent over $25,000, and nearly all of that, more than $34,000, was for consulting fees. It's not clear who that consultant was, or what work, if any, the consultant did. The group raised $32,000, but finished 2021 in the hole with negative assets of minus $22,000. It also listed total liabilities payable to officers at $37,900. GuideStar does not list a tax filing for 2022, and it's unclear whether the organization filed one with the IRS. We emailed the El Cajon Mother Goose Parade Association with a detailed list of questions. The organization responded by email, merely referring us to the statement on its website, adding, "There are no further comments nor news to be shared at this time." When that happens, you and East County Magazine will be some of the first to know, they told our editor. The lack of transparency raises troubling questions. What's happened to the financial assets? Who is the consultant paid for several years when no parade was held? And what work did the consultant perform? Where are the floats that have always appeared in the parade, such as the Mother Goose float that carried the Queen and her court, the Santa Claus float, and the giant inflatable balloons? We also sent a detailed list of questions to Daryl Priest via his construction company's secretary, and we requested an interview. Our questions asked about the status of the foundation, a current list of officers, and what efforts are being made to produce a parade next year, given that there are no fundraising events on the website and the donation page has been taken down. We also asked if the foundation intends to dissolve, since it is still shown as active by the Secretary of State, and if so, what will happen with the organization's assets? State law requires that if a nonprofit dissolves, its assets must be donated to another nonprofit with a similar mission. Priest did not respond to calls or email, nor did Shyrock, the vice president, when we left a voicemail message for her. And she's listed as the vice president, by the way, on the federal tax filings and the secretary on the state filing. Several other media outlets have run brief articles on the cancellation of this year's parade without delving into financial records. Parade organizers did not respond to inquiries from any of those media outlets either. El Cajon's city manager, Graham Mitchell, when asked why there is no parade again this year, said the parade association has indicated that the organization is defunct. He added, they said that if another organization wants to run with it, they would pass along the knowledge, but so far, nobody has come forward. Perhaps no other group has come forward to run the parade because the parade association has not made the need public. Might the East County Chamber of Commerce, the Downtown El Cajon Merchants Group, a service club or tribe be willing to step forward if they knew of the need? Or might the public volunteer to form a committee to save the parade, as was done when there was talk of tearing down the East County Performing Arts Center some years ago, which was ultimately saved and rebranded as the Magnolia Theater after the public made their voices heard? Or perhaps civic leaders and their families might step forward. People such as the widow of former El Cajon Mayor Mark Lewis, who recently passed away. His widow said her husband saw the Mother Goose Parade as a child and was so enchanted that he implored his family to move to El Cajon. City Manager Mitchell says he loves the parade, but doesn't seem to have feathers ruffled over potential loss of the long-standing tradition, which has drawn hundreds of thousands of visitors to the city, delighting children and the young at heart with fairy-tale-themed floats, marching bands, equestrian demonstrations, giant inflatable balloons, and more. We ask why the city hasn't put the parade's future on the City Council's agenda, to inform the public and perhaps consider short-term funding from the city, as La Mesa previously provided when a merchant group hosting Oktoberfest ran into financial troubles. Mitchell responded, I think it's probably a good time for the parade not to be around anymore, noting that participation and sponsorships have dwindled over the years. He said the city already underwrites several other major events, adding, we don't have the capacity to take this on. He recalled working in another city, however, where an event was canceled and the public came forward with volunteers to revive the event. Mitchell suggested that anyone who wants to see the Mother Goose Parade take wing once more to delight the public should let their feet do the walking, and he advised, I'd probably encourage them to form a new organization. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from San Diego's East County.
Campers at a short-term rental property in Julian's Pine Hills neighborhood started an unauthorized campfire on November 12th and failed to properly extinguish it. The embers sparked a brush fire, causing damage to the owner's property and panic for nearby neighbors. Julian resident Tracy Allen, in a Facebook post, said flames were 10 to 12 feet high when a neighbor saw the blaze and reported it. Cal Fire doused the fire, but Allen says that given the high winds, nearby homes would have burned down. Residents spoke out at the Julian Community Planning Group meeting the next night to voice concerns about the growing number of short-term vacation rentals in Julian, especially those without owners on site. Some vacation rental owners also spoke up in defense of property rights for responsible owners. The planning group is working on a draft letter to the county over previously voiced concerns about vacation rental homes. But the county assessor's office doesn't know exactly how many there are in the Julian area. Board member Kathy Moretti reported that county records show that 86 properties are registered as short-term rentals in Julian, including hotels and campgrounds, as well as vacation rental homes. These property owners are paying transient occupancy taxes, which brought in $1.3 million over the past couple of years, with about $490,000 benefiting community groups such as Julian's Chamber of Commerce, Historical Society, Women's Club, Art Guild, and the Vulcan Mountain Foundation. But sites such as Airbnb and VRBO list many more vacation rentals, 324 on Airbnb alone. However, these may include multiple rooms per home, and those websites also list nearby communities in a search for Julian. Short-term rentals are proliferating far beyond Julian. Alpine has over 1,000 listed on Airbnb, and even Warner Springs, a small remote mountain town, has 425. Board member Eric Jones called for the county to compare tax rolls against listings for vacation rentals. to research where some are dodging paying taxes. Barbara Nigra, another planning group member, said the short-term rental situation is out of control, adding, "We don't have many long-term rentals for residents to live in because so many of these houses have been turned into Airbnbs by people who just invested in a house and don't live here." Board member Ron Smith wants to see a balanced approach to protect residents while still allowing short-term rental owners to bring in tourists whose spending also supports shops and businesses in Julian. During public testimony, John Leslie said he owns several rentals and maintains good relations with his neighbors, as well as cameras on his properties. He suggested that residents communicate with our neighbors better to resolve problems. Some have complained that vacation rentals have priced local residents out of the rental housing market. But Leslie said local renters can't afford to pay enough to cover his mortgage and rising fire insurance costs. Keisha Green, a lifelong local property owner and vacation rental manager, said other counties have agreements for Airbnb to collect taxes on an app and said San Diego County should do so too. Anthony Napoli noted that the city of San Diego has a four-tier system for regulating short-term rentals, but doubts the county would do this. He owns three rentals, but acknowledges that there are problems, adding that one local vacation rental has had several citations from CAL FIRE, but hasn't been shut down. He says prices of short-term rentals are starting to come down due to oversupply. Most of the residents in attendance agreed that short-term rentals benefit the community financially, but many felt that money should not be the only consideration. Resident Laura DeVault said, "We could have been burned out." DeVault, who lives down the street from where the fire occurred, added that short-term renters have included noisy drunks and poachers, destroying her enjoyment of her own property. Another Pine Hills resident said she moved there to get away from Airbnbs in San Diego, only to find short-term rentals popping up in his new community in recent years. "They have destroyed Pine Hills. We have 6.5 miles, she said, noting there have been problems with party houses. "The problem is with off-site owners, not those who live on site," she and others affirmed. A man celebrating his 96th birthday said he came to Julian's Whispering Pines area 25 years ago. "Everything changes," he mused, "but when it starts to infringe on others' rights, that's a problem. You're changing Julian in a way that the people of Julian do not appreciate." Board member Ron Smith observed, "There's responsible management and irresponsible management. We should request a very stiff penalty for owners who are not managing their properties responsibly." He said owners should be there or hire someone, like hotels do. While some called for the county to adopt regulations of short-term rental properties, Moretti disagreed, stating, "I think we are going down a slippery slope, and I have a problem telling people what they can do with their properties." Owners of the property where the fire occurred posted an apology to neighbors on the Julian Connection Facebook page. They said that the guests were told that campfires were not allowed and voiced outrage over damage to their property caused by their renters' reckless disregard for the community safety. The property's owners pledged to shut down their campsite listing immediately and only rent interior rooms in the future, adding, "We agree that the risk the campsite poses to our property and to the community is too great to keep it going." The owners also said they will install additional signs to remind guests that campfires are prohibited and to remind them of fire safety rules. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell. We'll be right back.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. Detectives with the Rancho San Diego Sheriff's Station are asking for public help to identify the suspect or suspects responsible for shooting and injuring five people Saturday night in Spring Valley. Witnesses told deputies that a birthday party was being held at a home on Ildica Street around 8 p.m. when they suddenly heard gunshots. Deputies from the Rancho San Diego, Santee, and Alpine Sheriff Stations, as well as Lemon Grove, Lakeside, and Imperial Beach Sheriff Substations responded and found a frantic scene. Sergeant Noah Zero says deputies cleared and searched the area for the shooter or shooters, while other deputies provided first aid, applying tourniquets on the shooting victims to stop bleeding. A sheriff's canine handler and Astria helicopter also helped in looking for possible suspects, while officers from the La Mesa Police Department and California Highway Patrol established a perimeter around the area of the shooting. A 26-year-old man is hospitalized in critical condition. Four other shooting victims were taken to multiple hospitals with minor injuries, including two women ages 27 and 30 and two men ages 30 and 35. Two teenage boys were treated for burn injuries due to fireworks, according to Sergeant Zero. He adds it is the policy of the San Diego County Sheriff's Department not to release information about minor victims. At this time, he says the shooting appears to be an isolated incident and there is no known threat to the public, although no arrests have yet been made. The Sheriff's Department has declined to release further information, such as possible motive, while the investigation continues, and they're asking for tips to help solve the crime. Anyone with information about the shooting, including possible cell phone video or photos or surveillance video in the area, is urged to call Crime Stoppers. You can remain anonymous and be eligible for a reward of up to $1,000 for information leading to a felony arrest in this case by calling 888-580-8477.
A small congregation of Ukrainian-American Catholics will make Santee their new home once the church they have long planned is built in about a year. For local Ukrainian-Americans, whose homeland is war-torn since the Russian invasion began, construction of a church here symbolizes establishing roots in their new home in San Diego's East County. The parish, St. John the Baptizer, now holds its services in San Diego's North Park neighborhood. The parish purchased the lot at Carlton Oaks Drive and Pike Street in Santee back in 2018. In February 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, local Ukrainian immigrants held a candlelight vigil on the site of their future church. November 8th, the Santee City Council unanimously approved a conditional use permit for the gold-domed church and connecting meeting hall for the applicants, technically a part of the Ukrainian Church of Chicago. The issue that prompted concern from the council members was parking. The plan calls for a church with 76 seats and only 19 parking spaces. Assuming not everyone is car sharing or taking Ubers, it didn't seem as if it would suffice. Vice Mayor Laura Koval said she hoped overflow vehicles wouldn't park at the Carlton Oaks Plaza shopping center across the street, where spaces are already at a premium. Keith Kroger, the owner of the center, in a letter to the council, said because many of the center's tenants, including the library, a dance studio, and martial arts studio, have their busiest hours on the weekend, the lot is usually filled, with some cars even parking on unmarked and red-painted areas. He wrote, "I believe this church would make parking worse and prevent parents and children from the community the opportunity to patronize the Santee Public Library," then asked the city council to deny the permit. Luke Miller's great-grandparents were part of the original congregation and emigrated to this country in 1912. He told council members that the parish's intention is to be good neighbors and said the church would hold services only on Sundays for about 3 hours with around 50 congregants. Catherine George, a consultant to the church, said the project meets all the city's codes, including parking and height limitations. St. John's is meant to be a small neighborhood church. She said they do not have lavish or large events typical of Western weddings and the like. Instead, the focus is on small religious services. The parish has spent more than $500,000 so far, with more than $1 million more to prepare the land and build the church and hall, according to George. Councilman Ron Hall urged the church leaders to work out a deal with the Santee School District, which operates Carlton Hills Elementary School across Pike Street, but is not in session on Sundays. Miller agreed that he would do so, prompting Hall to make a motion to approve the permit, which was approved unanimously by the Santee City Council. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
This is Miriam Raftery with this week's Destination East County. Our region has a wealth of treasured holiday events coming up this season, from holiday lighting displays and craft fairs to local festivals, ice skating rinks, a train ride aboard the North Pole Express, a performance of the Nutcracker Ballet, and more. Julian Farm and Orchard will be transformed into a winter wonderland with its first ever ice rink from November 10th through January 1st, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The skating arena is a synthetic and water-free ice substitute that aligns with Julian Farm and Orchard's commitment to sustainability. You can rent their skates or bring your own. Enjoy snuggling by outdoor fires, roast marshmallows, and enjoy holiday tastes. Reserve a spot online at julianfarmandorchard.com. Pacific Southwest Railway Museum invites you to take a ride aboard the North Pole Limited Railway every Friday and Saturday from November 24th through December 16th, departing at 5 and again at 7 p.m. The fun starts at the festive Campo Depot, where guests pick up tickets and browse the holiday items in a gift shop. Once aboard the North Pole Limited, a crew of elves will regale you with holiday songs and stories, serve hot chocolate and cookies, and more as the North Pole Limited winds its way through the beautiful backcountry on its way to the North Pole, where it stops at Santa's workshop to pick up Santa and Mrs. Claus. On the ride back, Santa and Mrs. Claus will visit with all passengers on the train. For tickets, visit psrm.org. Pine Valley Camp Christmas has thousands of computerized lights strung on trees and a spectacular water show synchronized to holiday music. This year's event runs November 17th through 26th and again December 1st through 23rd from 5:30 to 9 p.m. You can also enjoy hay rides, bounce houses, laser tag, tree climbing, and many other games and attractions for all ages, plus tasty foods. For details, visit pinevalleycampchristmas.com. You're invited to El Cajon's annual Holiday Lights on Main Street in downtown El Cajon, Saturday, November 25th from 2 to 8 p.m. Festivities include ice skating on the promenade, family fun and live music with a tree lighting at 6 p.m. Entertainment on stage will feature the Audio Hounds Band and the Harmony Grove Band. It's also Small Business Saturday, where each year thousands of visitors come out to support local businesses. Find details at downtownelcajon.com. The largest outdoor ice rink in Southern California opens at Viejas Outlet Center in Alpine November 23rd through January 7th from 3 to 10 p.m. Skate rentals are available. You can also enjoy holiday shopping at the Outlet Center's many shops. For more info, visit viejasoutletcenter.com. For a roaring good time, you're invited to a turkey bash at Lions, Tigers, and Bears, where you can watch rescued big cats and bears savor their Thanksgiving feast. This special event takes place November 24th and 25th, the Friday and Saturday after Thanksgiving at 10 a.m. Tickets to this wild event are required. Guests are encouraged to bring an item from the nonprofit sanctuary's wish list. For tickets, visit lionstigersandbears.org. Julian hosts its annual Julian Country Christmas and Tree Lighting November 25th from 12 noon to 7:30 p.m. at the future home of the Julian Town Square. There will be a Christmas market with holiday vendors and crafts, plus entertainment throughout the day. Music will start at 2 p.m. and continue until the tree lighting at 5:30, after which Santa Claus arrives to meet and greet the children. This event is hosted by the Julian Merchants Association and Julian Chamber. Get details at visitjulian.com. Grossmont Center in La Mesa encourages you to shop local at its Holiday Fest Craft Market on Small Business Saturday, November 25th. The Holiday Fest is co-hosted by the Well Community for Women. Find a variety of heartwarming holiday gifts and treasures made by local artisans and vendors. You can also support the youngest entrepreneurs at the Children's Market inside the Well and visit Santa's Workshop. The Holiday Fest Craft Market is from 10 to 4 p.m. Later, from 3 to 6, the mall will have holiday performances and a tree lighting, partnering with the Salvation Army for their Red Kettle Kickoff and shows by musicians, dancers, gymnasts, and more. Plus, you can get photos with Santa and donate a new and unwrapped toy to the toy drive, as well as enjoy complimentary refreshments. Learn more at grossmontcenter.com. Santee Lakes hosts Lights at the Lakes Holiday Show on December 1st from 6 to 8 p.m. This event features a mile with over 100,000 lights and more than 35 larger-than-life displays all synced to the car radio. Tickets are available at santeelakes.com. Ramona's Chamber of Commerce hosts its annual tree lighting on December 2nd at the Guy B. Woodward Museum. This event runs 5 to 9 p.m. with the tree lighting at 7. Enjoy holiday decorations, late shopping and dining, classic cars, live music, vendors, crafts, dancing carolers, photos with Santa, and more. Find details at ramonachamber.com. La Mesa's historic downtown transforms into a Victorian-style village for the city's annual Holiday in the Village event on Saturday, December 2nd from noon to 9 p.m. The event is held in the heart of La Mesa's downtown along La Mesa Boulevard between Spring and 4th Streets. Visitors can stroll La Mesa's historic downtown while exploring dozens of local craft vendor stands, cozy up with artisans and craft foods as well. Friends and family can relax by fire pits while enjoying holiday caroling, cheerful holiday music, and fun live entertainment from local schools, clubs, and more. You can also get selfies with Santa, and children can enjoy a kids' area bigger than Santa's toy shop. For a full schedule of events, visit lamesavillageassociation.org. The City of Lemon Grove hosts its 24th annual Holiday Bonfire December 3rd from 4:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Tragansa Park on Main Street. The event includes live music, food booths, arts, crafts, a rock climbing wall, games, trucks, cookies and hot chocolate, and a giant bonfire to light up the night. Christmas on Mount Helix returns December 9th from 4 to 8 p.m., complete with a Christmas market to shop for holiday gifts, caroling, crafts, food trucks, a holiday program, and Santa. Shuttles will be available from Grossmont High School. Get details at MountHelixPark.org. You're invited to Christmas with the Animals, a fundraiser for the Lions, Tigers, and Bears Sanctuary in Alpine, where you can watch animals unwrap their Christmas presents Saturday, December 9th from 2:30 to 7:30 p.m. There's also a festival of lights, hot cocoa, and holiday beverages from a full bar, as well as a gift shop where you'll find special holiday gifts for those on your list. Members and guest rates are available, as well as an optional upgrade to feed an exotic animal alongside a keeper. For tickets, visit LionsTigersAndBears.org. Ho, ho, ho! Santa will be visiting the Crest Christmas Craft Show on Sunday, December 10th, arriving on a fire truck at the Crest Clubhouse. The family-friendly event features crafts, food, and music. Events start at 2, with Santa arriving between 4 and 6 p.m. On December 16th at 1 p.m., the San Diego Ballet brings the Nutcracker Ballet to the Magnolia Theater in El Cajon. The Nutcracker features Tchaikovsky's timeless musical score and an international cast of more than 100 beautifully costumed dancers, sugarplum fairies, leaping Cossacks, and flurries of snowflakes swirling across the stage in this magical journey through a young girl's imagination. Get tickets at MagnoliaSanDiego.com. Noah Holmes in Spring Valley will present its 6th annual Enchanted Village December 15th through 22nd from 5 to 8 p.m. Drive through 8 acres of holiday lighting with magical cottages, light tunnels, and over 1 million lights. Also enjoy live musical performances, carolers, hundreds of candy canes and Christmas trees, holiday displays, and more. All proceeds benefit NOAA Homes, a nonprofit providing housing and care to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. For tickets, you can visit enchantedvillage.org. That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions here in San Diego's East County.
San Diego Padres chairman and owner Pete Seidler, beloved by fans for investing in star players and bringing the team to the National League Championship playoffs last year, died November 14th at age 63. Asked last year about the Padres' payroll for this year, Seidler told a reporter, "I kind of like spending money. You can't take it with you." The San Diego Union-Tribune reports that the family's plan is for the Padres to remain in Seidler's family for generations. Padres CEO Eric Grubner made the announcement in a press release, remembering Seidler as a kind and generous man, devoted to his family, as well as for having a heartfelt compassion for others, especially those less fortunate. His impact on the city of San Diego and the baseball world will be felt for generations, Grubner said, adding, "His generous spirit is now firmly embedded in the fabric of the Padres." Fans turned out at Petco Park to show their respects Tuesday and Wednesday after the team opened up the stadium gates. Seidler earned his fortune as founder and managing partner of Seidler Equity Partners, a private equity fund supporting entrepreneurial companies. In 2020, he bought a majority stake in the Padres and invested hundreds of millions of dollars, including 5 9-figure deals to sign on star players, including Manny Machado, Fernando Tatis Jr., Xander Bogaerts, and hometown favorite Joe Musgrove of Alpine. He also approved trades to acquire Juan Soto and Yu Darvish. The team, which had languished near the bottom of the league in payrolls for decades, suddenly rose to third in payroll by 2023. The team made the postseason in 2020, then advanced to the playoffs in 2022, narrowly missing the playoffs in 2023, but setting a franchise record for attendance, according to MLBTradeRumors.com, which said of Seidler, "In a few short years, he turned the Padres from a basement-dwelling afterthought into a star-laden club that gave the residents of San Diego pride and excitement." During the spring training in February, Seidler remained optimistic about the team's chances of making the World Series in the future. "One day soon," he told the San Diego Union-Tribune, "the baseball gods will smile on the San Diego Padres, and we will have a parade." Seidler was also a leader in efforts to help San Diego's homeless and to invest in causes helping children and medicine. He worked with civic leaders to develop best practices for the homeless, donated over $1.6 million for large tents to serve as temporary shelter for homeless people, and formed a Tuesday group that met weekly to help these most vulnerable city residents. He was known to frequently walk through homeless encampments near Petco Park and in the beach areas near his home, talking with homeless people. Mayor Todd Gloria today praised Seidler as a true visionary leader who had a deep love for the game of baseball and the San Diego Padres, and also an unwavering commitment to our city. The mayor said Seidler was known for his great compassion for people experiencing homelessness, adding, "San Diego lost a truly special person today, but our city is a better place because of him." Nora Vargas, chairwoman of the San Diego County Board of Supervisors, called Seidler a pillar of our community, a generous soul, and a visionary leader whose profound impact on San Diego will forever be cherished. Seidler received many awards for these efforts. He and his wife also supported many charities, such as the American Cancer Foundation, the Mayo Clinic, and the Juvenile Diabetes Foundation. Locally, he was a primary donor to the Lucky Duck Foundation, helping homeless children, and served on the board of trustees for both the University of San Diego and Sanford Burnham Presbyterian Medical Discovery Institute in La Jolla. Media outlets, including Associated Press and the San Diego Union-Tribune, have reported that Seidler was a two-time survivor of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma cancer who underwent a medical procedure in September. The family has not released his cause of death. He is survived by his wife, Sheil, three young children, his mother, Terry Seidler, and nine siblings, including his brother, Tom Seidler, the Padres' senior vice president for community and military affairs. His grandfather was once owner of the Dodgers, moving the team from Brooklyn to Los Angeles. Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred said growing up in a baseball family gave Seidler a lifelong love of the game. Seidler would often travel to watch teams play in other cities, a rarity for baseball owners. He was passionate about owning the Padres and bringing the fans of San Diego a team in which they could always take pride. The MLB commissioner concluded, "He was an enthusiastic supporter of using the Padres and Major League Baseball to bring people together and help others. On behalf of Major League Baseball, I send my deepest condolences to Peter's wife, Sheil, and their family, his Padres colleagues, and the fans of San Diego." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
A growing chorus of voices on both the left and right are speaking out to warn of threats to U.S. democracy if former President Donald Trump wins election in 2024. The warnings come after increasingly vitriolic statements by Trump threatening to arrest political critics, eliminate free press rights, eliminate independence of the Justice Department and FBI, order the military to suppress peaceful demonstrations, round up immigrants in camps for mass deportations, and support, quote, termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution. The conservative Lincoln Club warns that America is in a fight for democracy, stating in a newly released ad, "The fate of your country, your family, and your freedom are on the line in the 2024 election. We're not liberals. We're not progressives," the ad continues. "We're former Republicans who put country over party. We're Americans who know that unless we stop Trump, he will end this democracy we cherish." Among those starring in anti-Trump Lincoln Club ads is Michael Steele, the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. In an interview on Univision in early November, Trump said, "If I happen to be president and I see somebody who is doing well and beating me very badly, I'll say, go down and indict them." The Washington Post on November 5th reported that Trump has told friends and advisors he wants the Justice Department to investigate former officials who criticized him, despite no evidence that any of them committed crimes, and some sought to prevent Trump from breaking the law. Those he hopes to target include General Mark Milley, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as well as Trump's former Attorney General William Barr, Trump's former Chief of Staff John Kelly, and former Trump lawyer Ty Cobb. To enable such actions, Trump has joined forces with the Heritage Foundation and other conservative groups to develop Project 2025. That's a plan that, among other things, would eliminate the Justice Department's independence from the executive branch. Constitutional law professor Saikrishna Prakash at the University of Virginia says, "It would resemble a banana republic if people came into office and started going after their opponents willy-nilly." Such actions would be clearly unconstitutional, law professor Bennett Gershman at Pace University told Salon. Ultimately, he said it would be up to the Supreme Court to step up and prevent Trump's plot to abuse his power. However, the High Court includes three justices appointed by Trump, making it unclear whether the conservative majority on the court would have loyalties with Trump or their duty to uphold the Constitution. The former president is facing 91 criminal counts in 4 different jurisdictions on serious charges backed by dozens of witnesses and reams of documents, including charges of conspiracy to overturn the 2020 election, fueling an insurrection, illegally retaining and sharing classified documents, obstruction of justice, falsifying business records, and more. He has called these prosecutions a witch hunt and vowed revenge if elected in 2025. Associated Press, on August 29th, reported that the 1,000-page Project 2025 also targets the federal deep state bureaucracy, with plans for Trump or another supportive far-right Republican such as Ron DeSantis or Vivek Ramaswamy to fire up to 50,000 federal workers, gutting or eliminating a sweeping range of federal agencies. The plan would replace career civil service professionals, who are supposed to be nonpartisan, with political appointees beholden to the president who would appoint them. Currently, only about 4,000 federal workers are political appointees. Trump, in a bizarre court filing in a Colorado case, actually argues that he did not take an oath to support the U.S. Constitution. That filing was made in a lawsuit that sought to keep Trump off the Colorado ballot, based on the 14th Amendment, which bans anyone who engaged in a supported insurrection from holding federal office. Trump's actions in support of the January 6th Capitol attack, which sought to disrupt counting of votes, and other actions to overturn legitimate election results should bar him from holding office, that lawsuit claimed. Trump previously said parts of the Constitution should be, quote, terminated after he lost his re-election bid in 2020 on his Truth Social platform. Trump said he would support termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution, that's a direct quote, to remain in power. Trump lost all legal challenges to the election results, with 62 judges finding no evidence of fraud in Joe Biden's win over Trump, including 3 judges appointed by Trump. He has praised dictators, including Chinese leader Xi Jinping, whom he admired for being president for life. Trump added, I think it's great. Maybe we'll have to give that a shot someday, suggesting that the U.S. constitutional limit of 2 presidential terms should be changed. Trump has also praised Russian Premier Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine. He has increasingly invoked violence and vitriolic rants on social media and in interviews, even threatening witnesses and inciting threats of violence against prosecutors, prompting a judge to impose a limited gag order. On Truth Social, he suggested General Milley should be executed for speaking against Trump. He has also attacked press freedoms in an unhinged rant on Truth Social, Trump's disinformation platform. He threatened to end freedom of the press and the First Amendment if he regains power. He called for investigations of NBC, MSNBC, and other major media outlets that have run coverage critical of Trump. He posted, why should NBC or any other of the corrupt and dishonest media companies be entitled to use of the very valuable airwaves of the USA free? Trump also called these media outlets the enemy of the people. Attacking a free press is a hallmark of dictatorships. So is deploying the military to quell civil unrest. Yet Trump has recently said he would invoke the Insurrection Act, not used since the Civil War, to have troops occupy U.S. cities and quell protests, starting on day one after his inauguration. In an article titled Trump's Retribution Plan, Becoming America's First Dictator, senior writer Chauncey DeVega for the news site Salon cites historical evidence and books on how dictators have seized power in other formerly democratic nations. He concludes, in a time of democracy crisis, the news media should be speaking truth to the powerful, shining a light on the threats to democracy and civil society. Donald Trump is an objective threat to American democracy and civil society. That is a fact, the journalist concludes, adding, Trump is getting worse, more dangerous, more bent on inciting violence. This is not a presidential candidate. This is a criminal defendant seeking to save his own skin, no matter how much damage it causes. The media must stop pretending this is a normal presidential horse race. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The Public News Service Dillon newscast, November 20th, 2023. I'm Mike Clifford. Young farmers in New York and across the nation want Congress to help them deal with climate change impacts.
Bayer's Farmer Voice survey finds 71% of farmers say climate change has impacted their farm. The Fifth National Climate Assessment finds that drier conditions are becoming more of a detriment to agriculture in the Southeast. But the problem of drying land is increasing since New York and other northeastern states had modest droughts in 2022. Holly Rippon-Butler with the National Young Farmers Coalition describes some climate-resistant practices farmers are using to combat climate change.
One of the most popular programs that farmers in our network are using is the high tunnel program. So this is one of the ways that farmers are adapting is building high tunnels on their farm, making sure that they've got some way to keep crops out of the weather or control the climate a little bit for their crops.
Conservation is becoming more important to farmers. The National Young Farmers Survey finds 83% of young farmers say their farm exists primarily to engage in conservation or regeneration change. Along with this, 86% of young farmers utilize regenerative agriculture practices, but less than half of younger farmers are taking advantage of USDA programs, which could prove beneficial to handling climate change. Edwin J. Vieira reporting.
Now from NBC News, Rosalind Carter, the former First Lady and humanitarian who championed mental health care, provided constant political counsel to her husband, former President Jimmy Carter. She died on Sunday at her home in Plains, Georgia. Carter was 96. In a statement, former President Jimmy Carter said, "Rosalind was my equal partner in everything I ever accomplished." NBC reports Rosalind Carter was widely recognized for her political shrewdness, drawing particular praise for her keen electoral interests. Next to Massachusetts, where voting rights groups say provisional ballot data from the 2022 statewide election highlights the need for same-day voter registration.
Provisional ballots are offered to voters at the polls if their personal information is incorrect or missing from the voter list. Last year, two-thirds of those ballots were rejected for administrative reasons, resulting in 1,600 fewer votes counted. Executive Director of MassVote, Cheryl Clyburn Crawford, says same-day voter registration would allow election officials to quickly determine a voter's eligibility and correct any registration errors on site.
Instead of turning people away, which discourages voters, it would encourage and empower voters.
Clyburn Crawford says same-day registration would also save the state money on election-related costs over time, but some opponents say it could lead to voter fraud despite a lack of evidence. I'm Catherine Carley reporting.
For folks in Massachusetts, residents must currently register to vote in person or online at least 10 days prior to an election. This is Public News Service. New research says natural disasters and pollution linked to climate change are contributing to factors to high rates of anxiety and depression among young people.
Researchers from San Francisco-based Hope Lab consulted experts and interviewed youth climate activists to determine how climate impacts, like wildfire, extreme heat, drought, flooding, and air pollution, are affecting young people's mental health. Dr. Emma Bruhlman-Senecal is research lead at Hope Lab and the author of the Climate Generation blog.
We are focusing on climate change because Hope Lab's mission is to support the mental well-being of young people, particularly those from communities that have been underinvested in. And it's clear that climate change is deeply impacting youth mental health, particularly the well-being of youth of color.
I'm Suzanne Potter.
Down in Minnesota, where like other states, I've seen a tidal wave of union organizing amid public support to improve pay and workplace conditions. However, labor leaders acknowledge the slow growth of membership is prompting questions about the movement's future.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics says nationwide the number of union jobs last year increased by nearly 2%, but the actual membership rate declined to 10.1%. In a recent University of Minnesota panel discussion, Bernie Burnham of the Minnesota AFL-CIO said the dynamics of organizing have changed, including smaller groups of employees pursuing contracts.
Like in retail, there are a lot of places that use self-checkout, so there are less workers in these stores, and they're not going the traditional route, the old-school route of joining these bigger bodies that are the bigger unions.
Despite the differences, she suggests there's a lot of energy among the newer voices. The experts added that corporations are taking a harder line on organizing and that under most laws, it's hard to enforce anti-union messaging. I'm Mike Moen.
Finally, Eric Tanoff lets us know a group of veterans is touting the national security benefits of the Inflation Reduction Act.
The organization Elected Officials to Protect America says the law, passed by Congress in 2022, will decrease the country's dependence on foreign sources of energy with a $370 billion investment in clean energy. Army veteran and Beaverton Mayor Lacey Beatty says in wake of the region's devastating wildfires and heat dome, she helped push for protections for renters in Oregon.
Well, I'm very proud of that legislation. I'm very proud that the governor signed it, and I was very proud to build the coalition to do it. Imagine what a tenacious mayor could have done if I wasn't focusing on climate-related emergencies. Like, we could have been building more pipes and schools and infrastructure and bridges.
Beatty says the recent disasters in the state have underscored the importance of taking action on climate change.
This is Mike Clifford, and thank you for starting your week with Public News Service member and listener-supported. Hear us on radio stations big and small, your favorite podcast platform. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I have a high degree of confidence that Americans will be involved. There are nine of them, but Americans' involvement will be an imperative, I think, for the president, rightly so.
Democratic Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal tells NBC the U.S., Israel, and Hamas are near a deal to release Americans and others taken hostage last month. The rumored Qatar-brokered deal for 50 of the 240 held could come in exchange for a pause in fighting. Activists nationwide continue to push President Joe Biden and his party to call for an immediate ceasefire. More than 2,000 protesters shut down the California State Democratic Convention in Sacramento Saturday.
We will not vote. We will not canvass. We will not give our money to any elected official who does not say ceasefire now.
The cancellation overshadowed endorsing a candidate to replace the late Senator Dianne Feinstein in the March primary. Representatives Adam Schiff and Katie Porter oppose a ceasefire. Representative Barbara Lee supports one and won the convention vote, narrowly beating Schiff. Fulfilling a promise to his far-right members, House Speaker Mike Johnson says he'll release thousands of hours of footage from the January 6th Capitol attack.
We are trying to have you up there now. We need to hold the doors of the Capitol.
More than 40,000 hours will gradually be posted on a House website. Johnson says it'll let Americans see for themselves what happened. A federal judge says North Dakota's legislative redistricting violates the Voting Rights Act by breaking up the power of the Native American vote. Turtle Mountain Chippewa Chairman Jamie Azur tells KFYR-TV the ruling's a major win for tribal nations.
It may seem like a simple redistricting case, but it's just an example of nations coming together to challenge when we feel wronged.
North Dakota lawmakers have until just before Christmas to draw new maps. At least 30 federal lawsuits across the country challenge legislative districts. Massachusetts voting rights groups say last year, two-thirds of provisional ballots, often from low-income Black and Latinx voters, were rejected for technical flaws. Cheryl Clyburn Crawford with Mass Vote says under same-day voter registration, election officials could clear much of that up.
Instead of turning people away, which discourages voters, it would encourage and empower voters.
Washington, D.C. and half of the states allow same-day registration. Former First Lady Rosalynn Carter has died at the age of 96. Carter was known as a staunch advocate for mental health and the elderly. Beloved wife of former President Jimmy Carter, Rosalynn visited more than 100 countries, built houses with Habitat for Humanity, and promoted public health and democracy across the developing world.
There's so many opportunities, and if I don't use the influence I have to help those people who need help, I think that's a terrible waste.
I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Royalty Free Music,
and Pod 5.
If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.